Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, San Francisco's oldest, most innovative public radio station.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner, down the street at the Stanford University campus.
And then they migrate to the air, and then off the air onto the internet on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. Go check it out.
Ken, today we're talking about Confucius, one of the great thinkers, one of the most influential thinkers of all time, but someone that you and I probably didn't study in graduate school to the extent we did Descartes, Plato, or Aristotle.
Well, that's true. Confucius is not a part of the sort of standard Western canon, but, you know, I did study Confucius as an undergraduate at Notre Dame in that great books program I got my degree in, a little bit at least, just a tiny bit.
Well,
but I don't claim to be any expert by any means.
Good for you and good for Notre Dame. I used to give a lecture on Mencius, but I'm afraid I never learned much more than I had to make it through one lecture.
Now, who is Mencius?
Mencius was not a student of Confucius, a couple of generations away, but one of the great exponents of his point of view.
So tell me, what's such a big deal? Tell me who Confucius was to begin with.
Well, Confucius was a 6th century resident of China, apparently descended from some nobility, but himself not wealthy, and I guess an illegitimate son of somebody.
6th century, that's 6th century BCE, right?
Yes, 6th century BCE, right. Born, I think, 550. Lived to a ripe old age, never seems to have had a steady job, wanted to, a little bit like Machiavelli, I guess. He hung around hoping to get a job as a sort of a secretary of state or secretary of the interior of the, with these various kings, but never really did. But he became known as a great man and a great teacher. Kings liked to be seen with him. They just didn't like to listen to him.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, I mean, what was he trying to tell these kings? What were some of his main ideas as far as you can
Well, if you said the main ideas of our civilization are those in the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you'd say the main ideas of Confucianism are contrast quite a bit with that. They're not individualistic. It's more like filial piety, order, education, ritual, devotion to the state. Those seem to be the things that Confucius thought were the key, not just to good government, but good life.
Yeah, he had this view that if everything is well-ordered in the individual, then everything will be well-ordered in the family, and the family is a part of a community, everything will be well-ordered in the community. If the community is well-ordered, the king will be well-ordered, and then it goes back the other way. If the king's well-ordered, the individual, the family, the community will be well-ordered, and then the families will be well-ordered, and then the individual will be well-ordered. It's all this great chain of well-orderedness that you can't, you know, you can't isolate any part of it from the other.
Well, it may not be too appealing to your average libertine, democratic American, but apparently it influenced great influence over centuries and centuries of Chinese civilization, I guess, right up until today.
Well, that's true. And it's not just a historical thing. If you look at the Chinese, not just China, but the Chinese diaspora, it's spread throughout the world in a way. And our roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen, looks into that. She files this report.
When we talk about Confucius, we're talking about a philosopher who died almost 2,500 years ago, a man whose life we know very little about, which is why it's amazing how much his influence is still felt today.
Chinese culture, Chinese society is so much of a Confucian society.
Ji Lu Liu is a visiting professor of philosophy at Cal State Fullerton.
Even though people may not know this is Confucius' teaching, even though they are not following his teaching or listening to the doctrine, the way they interact with each other is all prescribed by Confucius.
Confucius laid out a prescription for how a person should live his or her life. It's not about happiness or self-fulfillment. It's about humility, respect for one's elders, and education.
You know, in the traditional society, parents would have absolute authority, and children have to just obey. There will be no consideration of nursing home or, you know, abandoning the parents, and that's a lifelong commitment. I was brought up in that kind of atmosphere, even though my parents did not study Confucianism. But there's always this kind of implicit idea that to study means to never give up your effort, to always strive at your best. And there is a Chinese saying that, you know, learning is like rowing a boat upstream. So whenever you stop, you're going backwards. So you can't relax. You know, you can't take breaks. You just always need to go to the next step.
I find it difficult to boast about myself. most Americans don't have any problem there.
Him Mark Lai grew up in San Francisco's Chinatown. His first name, Him, means modesty. When he was a boy, Him's father taught him Confucian proverbs.
Well, one of the things I remember is that I should every day examine myself. Am I true to others? Am I, honest? And I think the main thing that I get from Confucian philosophy is don't go to extremes. And of course, you know, that is very, very contrary to Western philosophy too, which is that you got to be a winner and you don't compromise, you know. I think the thing is, in the Chinese, the family also gets into the act. To do well in education and do well in life also reflects on the family. And the family do pitch in to help so that together, even though individually they may not make enough, but together there's enough so that they can get an education and be successful. So I think the family part is different from American ethos.
The Confucian concept of a moral person is, in a lot of ways, the traditional Chinese concept of a moral person. I asked Ji Lu to describe what that life is like.
Internally, he will be constantly examining himself. He would always ask himself whether he is doing his best, whether he is putting up his best effort, whether he is being honest with his friends, whether he is dutiful, whether he is proper in all different social contexts. He's someone who is kind of careful in self-examination. So there were stories about Confucius, for example, if he walked by a funeral procession, you know, he would just change his appearance. He would show respect. He would not be laughing or talking out loud when other people are engaged in something serious. So he's always observant of what's going on around him. The Confucian tradition is not yourself. No, that's being selfish, because there's no self outside of a family or a society network. So yourself is defined in terms of how you can contribute to the family and how you can contribute to society.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Thanks, Amy, for that very interesting piece. You know, humility, respect for elders, education, those are things that I really value. I could get behind, particularly that respect for elders. As you get older, you appreciate some values more and more.
Yeah,
that's definitely one of them.
Well, John, I bow to you, John, as my elder. Okay, and I defer to you.
Well, don't bump your head there.
Okay. Huh? Well, let's bring our guest on. We're joined today by Paul Chelberg. He's a professor of philosophy at Whittier College. He studied at the Donghai University in Taiwan and also at the University of Hawaii before completing his PhD down at Stanford, our place of work. That was a while ago. He's the editor of Essays on Skepticism, Relativism, and Ethics in Shuangzi. Paul, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, Ken. Hi, John.
Hi, Paul. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Now, let me ask you this. We've all heard of Confucius, but most of us, in the context of saying little pithy sayings like Confucius said, who would ever want to leave a house except by the door? Now, that's very deep, and you can, you know, think about that for a long time. But is there really a systematic philosophical vision underlying all these sayings? I mean, tell us a little bit about it.
I think there is certainly a systematic vision, and it was articulated differently by different ones of Confucius's followers, and we can triangulate back a little bit on what the original vision probably was. As you mentioned earlier, he didn't leave any writings himself. His disciples, after he died, realized that they were losing sight of him, and they got together a few times to write down what were for them the more memorable things that he said. But even then, they were only thinking about remembering these things for themselves. They weren't thinking about laying the vision out for us thousands of years and a whole continent away. So it is difficult to piece together, and it takes some work. But some of the central ideas, I think, you've already touched on, the important role of study, and Confucius really is the patron saint of study in China, the role of study both in showing you how to fulfill your role and how to do the right thing, but also in learning to see yourself as part of a larger community and a larger society.
So it's this idea that I believe Ji Lu in the roving philosophical reporter's piece said that no self outside of a family, no family outside of a state, something like that. That imbues the whole philosophy there.
Confucius lived at a time what was called poetically the Spring and Autumn. It was the decline of the Zhou Dynasty, and it later became more frankly referred to as the Warring States. And he found this disintegration deplorable, so he was trying to avoid it. And part of the role of study, because they did have a common tradition, that all the different states which were in increasing competition, they shared one common tradition. So by immersing yourself in this tradition, you were more able to see yourself as on the same side as all the other people.
So wait a minute, that's an interesting thing. I just want to... So he lived at a time of sort of dissolution, right?
Yes,
the warring factions. So this talk about well-ordered families and well-ordered societies and all that, that was an ideal that wasn't present at the time he was thinking and writing, but he was hearkening back to some golden age or something like that? Is that the right way to think about it?
That's right, and that's why study is so important. This is something we have to strive hard to achieve. One important word, as I said, is xue, study, but it might be useful to link it to another important word, which is zhen. Traditionally, zhen is translated as benevolence or sometimes more broadly as goodness. But I think for our purposes, we can understand it as kindness. And the Analects 1.2 says that the family is the root of kindness, because it's in the family that we learn to see other people as of a kind with ourselves, and their happiness is part of our happiness, and their success is part of our success. And part of the function of education is to take that natural kindness that we feel in the family and extend it until it embraces others in our society and potentially even the whole world.
Paul, when I did at one time spend a little time on Mencius, and I remember he mm-hmm. had quite a... He thought human beings were basically good, if I remember it, and that this was something he got from Confucius, although it was a little bit more complex in Confucius, and other people thought he had the wrong interpretation. But it sounds like he thinks there is this basic kindness in human beings, and education will develop it, and that's kind of the secret of getting everything off to a good start. So it's not sort of original sin and guilt type philosophy, but original kindness and education type philosophy. Is that right?
For Mencius, he was the first great follower of Confucius who, as you mentioned earlier, studied with Confucius' grandson. He said, he's famous for saying, "Ren Xing Shan," people are by nature good, meaning that kindness is incipient in us and education just develops this natural inclination. Shortly after him was another important thinker, Xunzi, who is famous for saying, "Ren Xing people are by nature bad." By which he did not mean original sin, though I think the way we understand it, but that kindness isn't a natural inclination that we have, but it's a second nature that we can acquire by virtue of study and discipline. So for both of them, study plays a very important role. The question is just whether study is bringing out an incipient inner nature or acquiring a second nature.
That debate between them, was that a debate about sort of how people are, or was that a debate about the right way to interpret the great master? In some ways you could say, well, who cares what Confucius said, but I take it they both thought of themselves as interpreting Confucius somehow, is that right?
To some degree, but that was less important to them, that they were all itinerant political advisors and teachers, counseling people on how to rule and teaching students how to counsel people on how to rule. So the real question is, which theory is more effective in governing?
Yeah. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject is the great Asian philosopher Confucius and the philosophical tradition he founded. Our guest is Paul Chelberg from Whittier College.
We've been learning about Confucius, who he was, the nature of his influence over ancient Chinese culture. Coming up, we'll look at the main tenets of Confucian ethical and political philosophy.
And we want you to join us. We'll take your calls after the break. Philosophy Talk, we'll be right back.
That instrumental piece was an embroidered purse. It was performed on a traditional Chinese instrument called the struck zither. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing Confucius and Confucianism. Join us.
The number is 415-841-4134. I'll repeat, 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, toll free, 1-800-525-9917. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
And when you do, tell us your views on Confucian ideals. Is service, filial piety, and that sort of thing a better guide to life than such traditional Western American values as individualism, liberty, the pursuit of happiness? Tell us what you think.
Our guest is Paul Chelberg from Whittier College. Paul, as I read about Confucianism, ritual seems to play a very major role in Confucian philosophy. Reminds me of when I read the Old Testament, Deuteronomy, all this endless stuff about ritual. That doesn't resonate to the American consciousness today. Can you tell us a little bit more about ritual and why it was so important?
Actually, I think a lot of that is a translation problem. The word translated as ritual, Li, did refer to very specific things like, you know, how you fold your robe and things like that, and also very large things like the conducting of state ceremonies. But it also referred to what time of year you plant your crops, how to conduct yourself in certain kinds of offices, what you should do if you're a doctor, what you should do if you're a governor, what you should do if you're a police chief. One thing that's true is that knowledge wasn't categorized then by academic disciplines the same way that it was for us now. So that there was this body of traditional literature known as the ritual, which contained the collected wisdom of previous generations. And through the study of it, one learned how to take one's place in society, how to play on the team. And for us, it's very easy to distinguish rituals, which we think of as arbitrary or somewhat frivolous, from things like science. But at that time, those things were sort of mixed together.
So ritual is just one aspect of Li, which might mean propriety or good manners or doing anything carefully in the way it ought to be done. Is that more the spirit of it?
Yes. And Confucius said in Analects 7:20, he said, "I was not born with knowledge, but I love the past and look for it there." I think that Li really includes almost anything that you have to study in order to know.
Give us a call. Join our discussion. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside the Bay Area, you can call us toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. Okay, Paul, I want to ask you more about this, though, this ritual thing. So ritual includes what we would think of as ritual, I guess, and more than that, right? But for Confucius, as I read it and understand it, and tell me if I'm right, it's a deeply ethically significant notion.
That's
this
right.
Notion of ritual.
Actually, I mean, the way the word, just on a grammatical level, the way the words function is ritual is what you study. In English, you eat food. In Confucius's Chinese, you xue li. So it's all the things that need to be studied in order to be learned. And the idea, again, is that being a part of the human family, playing on the human team, is what it is that we learn.
Okay, but help me. I understand that, but I still want to understand how we think. So if you think of ethics in kind of the Western tradition, it has some overlap with Confucian ethics, because both ancient Greek ethics and ancient Chinese ethics seem, at least as I understand them, to focus a lot on virtue rather than moral rules, right? But but all this stuff about mourning for 3 years, and, you know, if your heart's not in their ritual, that Confucius says, then I'd rather not be there. He talks about, you know, if a sacrifice, I can't remember the exact quote, but there's this, if you're at a sacrifice and your heart's not in it, I'd rather not be there. I mean, he goes on and on about this sort of stuff. But that's supposed to be part of sort of goodness and being a good person. Help me get my head into that.
These rituals were places where the community came together, and the community came together around things that were important to them. And frequently, you know, something like a funeral when someone dies is very challenging to the community. And it's important there, as I think it is for us now, for families to get together around funerals and to think about their relations to one another. Confucius was also very, very fond of music when communities came together for concerts, which were funded by the whole community. And certainly those for him were the kinds of community efforts that were most beautiful and meaningful, as opposed to, say, military expeditions.
It's kind of evocative of how we think of small town America, people coming together for the 4th of July celebration and the playing of the Star Spangled Banner before the local ball club and things like that. We lose a lot of that in our decentralized society, where we all listen to Star Spangled Banner, but we're sitting in our separate couches and watching it on TV. Still, ritual just doesn't seem to be as important to us as it was to ancient Chinese culture.
But if you think of ritual, I think Paul's saying, I'm not sure I've got you right, Paul. If you think of ritual as a way of organizing our shared life together, a way of organizing our interactions together, you can see how it could be a deeply ethically significant notion, and respecting the old ritual forms is living up to the old virtues and values in a certain way. Do I have that right, Paul, at all?
It probably doesn't play the same role in our lives as it did in theirs, but it probably plays more of a role in our lives than we realize. Take, for instance, something like Thanksgiving is a ritual. Families come together, and it's nice that we have these rituals where we come together just to come together rather than for some other function like cleaning out the garage. Those rituals do play an important part of our lives. Or to take another one, think about that first baseball game after 9/11. That was an important ritual in everyone's mind, and it was just a game.
Yeah. Pablo in San Francisco wants to weigh in on this point about ritual, I think. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Pablo.
Yes, but could I ask a quick question first, and that is, what is a more, or what is the standard, or what have you, accepted term? Is it Confucianism or Confucianism? I've heard both. And then the second point is, my take on this point that you're discussing right this second is that, you know, in fact, we have many rituals. I mean, I regret to, you know, sort of throw out the concept of the Super Bowl, you know, but we have many of these things. They may be, you know, fragmented, as you're saying, or decentralized, but they may also still serve a very similar function. So that's my thought.
Thanks, Pablo. Interesting points.
You got an answer to his question about the correct...
First of all, Confucianism is the usual one, although some people might coin a different one if they're trying to make a distinction between Confucianism in theory or Confucianism as it's practiced or things like that, because the Confucian tradition is so huge and it's very complex. And just as in the Western tradition, there are many, many different schools of philosophy which bear little in common with one another or Socrates. Mm-hmm. Within Confucianism, there are an awful lot of different kinds of things that you could talk about which bear more or less of a relation to Confucius himself.
Speaking of different schools of philosophy, Will in Alameda has a question about different schools of Chinese philosophy. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Will.
Yeah, I was wondering how Confucianism relates to Taoism, if they were separate traditions, kind of opposite trends, or if Confucianism is derived from Taoism. And if we have parallels in Western philosophers, say a mystical tradition like Thoreau or Emerson versus a more pragmatic philosophy like William James or Thomas Dewey or something like that.
Confucianism certainly seems much more affirming of the process of daily life and optimistic than Taoism. But let's let Paul, our expert, weigh in here.
That's a very tough question. Confucius lived in a period that is known in retrospect as the Age of 100 Philosophers. So there were a lot of different thinkers around.
Sounds great.
And, in many ways, but it was also, again, called the Warring States, so it had its downside. And they were later classified into schools in the Han Dynasty several centuries later. So a historian named Sima Qian was the one who came up with the term Dao Jiao or Taoism as opposed to Confucianism. So it's difficult for us to tell how those thinkers thought of themselves. We don't even really know how aware they were of one another. Later on, by the end of the period, you can tell that they've read each other's texts and are responding to them. But in the middle, it's a little bit hard to say. And those Taoist texts are so weird. And the more you learn about them, the weirder they get. It's hard to tell.
Give me a taste of the weirdness of Taoist texts. When you say that, that's a provocative thing. Give me a taste of the weirdness. What are you referring to?
Well, there's all this stuff about the way, but what's the way?
Well, in Zhuangzi, for example, who is probably most familiar to Western readers as the guy who dreamt he was a butterfly and then didn't woke up and wasn't sure if he was a butterfly dreaming he was a man or a man who was dreaming he was a butterfly. He tells all these strange stories. Which frequently have Confucius figuring in them. And sometimes Confucius is being ridiculed. Sometimes he's being made kind of a straightforward spokesperson of Taoism. Sometimes, I think probably most significantly, he's being shown as someone who changes his mind and who learns. And Confucius himself talks about how he learned his whole life. And Zhuangzi says, Confucius has been going along for 60 years and has changed his mind for 60 times. How do I know that what he believes today he won't change his mind about tomorrow? Which is an interesting comment because you're not sure whether it's a criticism or an honorific. And then there's one other really, really weird one where Confucius says, another important ritual, getting back to Pablo's question, other kinds of rituals. There are, you know, rituals like games where people come together. There are political rituals like, you know, for us, the president is the only one who has the the flags on his limousine and has the song. And if Arnold had them play, Hail to the Chief when he came in, we'd be very upset. for Confucius, all these kinds of rituals were important for keeping society stable. And the most important ritual is language, because after all, language is just something we learn. You're not born knowing how to speak. And that language is probably the most fundamental way in which we come together as a community. And yet in the Taoist text, Zhuangzi has Confucius saying, I've heard of the way that is unspoken, but I've never tried to speak it. I wish I had a beak 3 feet long.
Paul, what do you make of that? I don't know what to make of that. Tony's question, I think it was Tony's question, Will's question, that prompted an interesting discussion. It's a big topic, the whole history of Chinese philosophy. We'll put some resources on our blog that will help you sort through some of this. But I want to ask you something, Paul, really quickly. This focus on ritual, I don't think we should overemphasize it in a certain way. It's not the mere form that mattered to Confucius, right, as I understand
That's
it.
Right.
You had to perform these rituals sincerely. And the underlying sincerity was the deep and important thing. Isn't that right?
That's right. Although there's a continuum between sincerity and performance, I think, that in our tradition, the notion of the kind of religious value of intent as something that is between you and your God is absent from the Chinese tradition. One way to think about it might be this. Confucius was talking primarily to political leaders who were concerned first and foremost with political conquest. And Confucius told them that it's important not just to go through the motions of caring for all the people under your responsibility, but also actually following through and really caring for them. And Confucius believed that someone who really cared about them would ultimately be more effective than someone who just pretended to care about them.
Okay, thanks for that, Paul. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. You can call in, join the conversation, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We're talking to Paul Chelberg about Confucius. Paul, let me just ask a couple practical questions. Now, I went to my shelf and I pulled down the Analects of Confucius, translated and annotated by Arthur Whaley, which one time cost 95 cents. I'm sure it costs a lot more now, but it's a inexpensive paperback. Is that a good edition of the Analects, or is there another one you'd recommend to our listeners?
Oh, my goodness. There are numerous editions of the Analects. Probably the best thing to do is to get a couple of them and compare them.
well, that's pretty ambitious. How about somebody who just wants to have one to read every so often?
Now, you're putting me on the spot.
Okay, well, let me throw out another one here that's readily available.
He doesn't want to offend all the editors and translators out there.
This is a book that's got a lot more than the Analects in it. It's The Wisdom of Confucius by Lin Yu Tang, and it's one of those modern library books that are fairly inexpensive.
Lin Yu Tang is a very, very interesting figure in his own right. One of the things you learn when you read this stuff seriously as an academic is you can't just read the original text, you read the commentaries. Because Chinese, it's the same Chinese now as it was then, but it's changed. So words have taken on different meanings, grammatical structures have changed. So as you read over the years, you have these commentators explaining the text for you. And one thing that you realize is the text is viewed through a huge variety of lenses. And we talked before about Mencius seeing Confucius as someone who thought that education was a process of bringing out our natural tendencies, as opposed to Xunzi, who thought that education was a process of getting a second nature. Well, but then you begin to get Buddhist readers and all different kinds of readers, and they see the Analects very differently, and it becomes very difficult to say which one is the right vision.
Well, let me tell you a little story about that. The great South American writer Borges was at one time interested in being a sinologist, and he writes as following. He says, I came across a memorable passage. This is from Confucius, and the passage was, it matters little to a convict under a death sentence if he has to walk on the edge of a precipice. But then there was a footnote, and the footnote said, the translator said, the alternative translation of this is, the servants destroy the works of art so as not to have to adjudicate on their merits and defects. Well, now, do we really have any idea what these people were saying?
Well, I think that example is a little fictional, because actually the quote is from Zhuangzi, not Confucius. But it's true. But you're right.
What can you say?
Yeah, it's Borges. That's understandable. But as with almost any language, it's open to a variety of readings, not an infinite variety, And you make your reading based on evidence, and some of it is grammatical textual evidence, other historical evidence of the kinds of things people were concerned about at the time. So, for example, we've referred a few times to the fact that Confucius was giving practical political advice to kings. That's a very, very different thing from a contemporary philosopher who's trying to get his paper published in JPhil. It's going to affect the way he writes.
Let's let some callers into this conversation. Carolyn in Berkeley is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, what's your question, comment?
Yeah, I was curious about Confucius' relationship with the females in his family, and if you knew anything about what that relationship was like with his wife, or if he had any daughters, and how possibly his wife influenced some of his thinking. And another question was about, you know, people who followed his thinking, and how were females involved in, how were they able to participate on that level, if you have any of that information as well?
Thanks, Carolyn. Paul, you want to tackle that?
That's a very important question. We have precious little information about Confucius himself on the subject, although his way of thinking is his emphasis on the past. An important thing to think about is the degree to which a philosophy is responsible for its first most obvious misinterpretation. And the most predominant misinterpretation of Confucianism throughout the tradition was interpreting the study of the past with the worship and imitation of the past. And the Confucian tradition throughout most of its period has been very, very conservative, and that's had devastating effect for women in China in particular.
But you think that's a misinterpretation of Confucius? He does. I mean, he says that there's this saying, I merely pass on what's in the past, or something like that. I don't innovate.
That's right.
Or something like that.
And there are examples of him saying, you know, why he someone wants to substitute one kind of animal for another in a sacrifice because it's cheaper. And Confucius says, they value the money, I value the tradition, I value the ritual. However, there are other examples of where Confucius is willing to be flexible and to take into consideration other concerns. And he also talks about the rituals of the Zhou being superior to the rituals of the Shang and the rituals of the Xia dynasties, because they were able to look back on the past and learn from that experience. So he's a difficult character to pin down.
Now, Paul, I read somewhere that Confucius was divorced, and that his wife probably left him because he was so picky about the preparation of his meals. And then somewhere else I read that actually his father was divorced and his son was divorced, as if this was almost a mark of distinction. Any truth to that?
We'll find out after the break. We'll leave you in suspense. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing Confucius with Paul Chelberg, professor of philosophy from Whittier College.
Coming up, we'll talk about the enduring influence of Confucianism in modern Chinese and Chinese-American culture. Were Confucian teachings a part of your upbringing? If so, share your experience with us.
Philosophy Talk will be right back.
Well, folks, if you thought you recognized George Harrison and his sitar there, you're wrong. That was another piece of traditional Chinese instrumental music, Night Rain on the Plantain, performed on a 16-string instrument called the Cheng. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing Confucius with Paul Chelberg of Whittier College. Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917, or email us, comments@philosophytalk.org.
We left the audience, the listeners, hanging. You were going to answer John's question about the divorce and all that, and whether it was an urban legend.
We have just not enough reliable evidence about Confucius's own biography to know that. But it's certainly true that women's issues were not high on his list of priorities in his own practice or in the tradition that followed from him. There is one notable exception, though, that's interesting. Mencius, who we were talking about before, who was a student of Confucius' grandson and said that people are by nature good, we have a natural inclination to kindness. There are a lot of stories about Mencius and his mother. And his father died, and mentions his mother moved several times because I guess they were living next to a cemetery, and she looked out and saw little Mencius pretending to be a grave digger, so she grabbed him up and moved. Then they were living next to a store, and she saw him pretending to be a merchant, which she thought was not acceptable, so she grabbed him up and moved. And then they were next to a school, and he was practicing being a teacher, which she decided was good enough, so she stayed there. So it seems as though in Mencius's case, a positive experience with his mother and with his family growing up does seem to have been influential on his philosophy.
Paul, that's very interesting. I want to talk to you about something that's connected with innovation and connected with the theme of this part of the show, which is continuing influence. China's culture is famous for inventions like movable type, gunpowder, fireworks, many of them centuries before the similar things were invented in the West. Yet is there anything in Confucius's philosophy that emphasizes the good qualities of innovation and change and thinking for yourself and coming up with new ideas? And is this part of the reason that Mao Zedong didn't want Confucianism around? It was too stifling? What's your take on that set of questions?
That's a tough call. I mean, any large tradition has in it resources enough either to support or to discourage something like innovation. So it's hard to say it's all one way or all the other. And as you pointed out, while there were very conservative periods and tendencies within the Chinese tradition, there were also very, very innovative periods and tendencies, all of which come under the general umbrella of Confucianism. So you can't really say that Confucianism is one way or the other. However, one kind of central theme, which is the value placed on social harmony and stability, and that innovations that aren't conducive to social harmony and stability are probably not going to be as immediately valued as they might be.
So you could
in the Western tradition.
So you could never justify a women's movement or the emancipation of a previously oppressed class on the basis of Confucian ideals. I mean,
I think you certainly could, but you would do it in a different way. And
this is
hard to say because again, the Confucian tradition is huge, and there are people in the Confucian tradition basing their arguments on ideas of human rights and things like that. But you could also make those same arguments on something more resembling a communitarian basis, or even something that we would think of like an ethic of care, as being justifications for advocating the rights of women.
So let me ask you a question about the continuing influence of Confucius. Mm-hmm. Is it still with us in China, in the Chinese diaspora? We said that in the Amy Standen piece, but do you agree with that? Is it still with us?
Oh, sure. Yes, very much in the Chinese diaspora. Again, just like there's so many different Confucianisms, there are now an awful lot of different Chinas, and they're quite different from one another. During the communist period in mainland China, Confucianism was generally thought of as something that had held the Chinese country back, so that he was not popular. And then Mao kicked off the Cultural Revolution with the official Piping Kongmeng, the criticized Confucius and Mencius campaign. Now people look back at the Cultural Revolution as something that is generally thought of as somewhat regrettable, and Confucianism has risen since then, although it hasn't risen as much as the market has with Deng's market reforms.
Let's get one last caller in. CK in Oakland, you want to weigh in on something about the liberalism and conservatism of Confucianism, right?
Yes. I'm probably just pointing out the obvious, but Taoism isn't exactly conducive to social harmony and stability in the Confucian sense, is it? I mean, there's a passage in The Intellect, striking, where Confucius says, if I can't find people to associate with who steer a middle course, then I'll settle for associating with the crazy and the timid. I mean, the crazy will do anything, and there are things the timid will never do. That's not exactly that's not a line of thinking it seeks to institute great change anywhere. It seeks to pretty much keep things as they are. And I remember that Zhuangzi portrayed Confucius as a sort of philosophical stumblebum who had failed to understand the Tao. As liberal and conservative alternatives to philosophy,
CK, you think this great Chinese tradition gives us a lot of different plates we can eat from in terms of
definitely.
Okay, thanks for the call,
Paul. You want to make one last comment on that?
Well, not just does it give us different plates we can eat from, but each one of the plates you can eat from for a long time and see it in a lot of different ways. There's no end of interpretation to any one of these texts.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us. That'll have to be the last word. Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Paul. And we also want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to and emailers we didn't get a chance to read the email of.
Our guest has been Paul Chelberg, professor of philosophy at Whittier College, editor of Essays in Skepticism, Relativism, and Ethics in Zhuangzi. So, John, what's your state of mind today? What have you learned?
Well, as usual, I learned quite a bit. I learned a little bit more about the life and times of Confucius, about the nature of the Confucian tradition, the basic concepts, and the enduring role of Confucianism, even as Amy's piece showed in Chinese America.
You said something about, after Amy's piece, you were really impressed by those Confucian values and kind of suggested that you might prefer them to Western individualistic values. Were you serious about that? I mean, there's something we're missing in our over-individualism that we could learn from Confucius?
I don't know if I prefer... Well, let's... One of the three was education, and I think education is undervalued in California, undervalued in America. I don't know. I don't think that's part of our tradition. It just seems to be a kind of corollary of not spending money on taxes. So I'm all for that value. Humility, well, I think humility is one of those, like Aristotle's golden mean. I think Confucius also had a golden mean. You don't want to be too humble, but you don't want to be too arrogant and full of yourself either. Filial piety, I don't know. Respect for the elders.
With all your grandchildren, yeah. I would think filial piety would be a big thing. The thing I think about this is...
Self-interested motive for that virtue.
The thing I think about this is that our society is under-ritualized. We could learn something about that from Confucian. But you know what? You should... read our blog if you want to continue this conversation because we're running out of time.
We're trying to ritualize our blog.
Yeah, www.theblog.philosophytalk.org.
And now it's time for Philosophy Talk Goes to the Movies. Ken, seen any good movies lately?
Yeah, you know, my wife and I just went to see Million Dollar Baby. I loved it. It was a great movie.
I agree with you. I thought it was a very good movie. I thought it was well acted, well directed. I've liked Clint Eastwood since he was on Wagon Train about 100 years ago.
There's a really deep point here about autonomy, self-control, and owning one's own life, right? But I think we got to tell something about the story to make that point. So Hilary Swank is this boxer. I guess she's not very good at it, right? She comes to Clint Eastwood's studio.
I think it's called a gym, Ken.
Clint Eastwood's gym, and says, "Train me, boss." But he says no, he refuses. But she keeps trying and trying and trying to get his attention.
She gets his attention. She becomes kind of his daughter figure. He takes great pride in her, cares a lot about her, tries to keep her safe. She does awfully well, but eventually she's really delivered a blow, a blindside after the bell blow that knocks her over. She hits her head on the stool, and she becomes a quadriplegic.
Yeah, and she can't stand it. She wants to die.
There's kind of two issues that come up here. One is the general issue of euthanasia. In the end, Clint Eastwood helps her die, and a lot of people have criticized the movie for representing in a sympathetic way this decision he made against his Catholic faith to help someone end their life. Even if the whole issue of euthanasia you don't think it's morally unacceptable, it's okay to portray it in movies as done by sympathetic characters. Still, to me, there was the question, what exactly were the circumstances? I'm not clear that she did want to die immediately upon finding herself in the hospital as a quadriplegic. It was only after her family came in, and it was clear that they were just interested in getting the rights to all of her possessions and everything. After her break with her mother, that's when she really gets depressed. Well, and I wonder, in that circumstances, was Eastwood's decision correct?
Well, there's two things. There's Eastwood and there's her. I want to talk about her, and then we can talk about Eastwood. She said to Eastwood, "Look at what I've had. Look at where I've been. I've scaled the heights, right? And this is what's left to me. And I don't want to live this life, basically. I don't want this life. I choose a life that ends like this, with me dying now, having scaled these heights, rather than going on as a quadriplegic, right, with nothing to look forward to with this greedy family of mine. I choose a life that ends now. Help me in my choice." Right? I think her choice, her desire, is deeply rational and is tied up with her wanting to control the narrative structure of her own life, right? I don't want my life to go on and be this story. I want to write that story. So I think her choice is deeply rational and very powerful.
I'm not so sure her decision is rational. I think her depression hits in with a series of events that are in addition to the quadriplegia, the virtual desertion of her by her family, her realization that they're hopeless. And then she begins to have circulation problems that lead to the need to amputate her leg. Now, it may be in that case, given all of that, it was rational. She saw the end coming bits by bit, and she didn't want to do that. But if it's just the idea that she used to be a boxer in full command of her body, and now all she's got left is her brain and her mind and her friends, I don't think that's rational. I think Clint Eastwood should have said to her, look, Hillary, what made you a great boxer wasn't your physique. It was that brain, and you've still got it, and you can scale lots of other heights.
Look, everybody's going to die at some point or other. You might think, well, that's a really bad thing. But look, every life ends. And you don't judge the goodness of a life by the thing that comes after the life. You judge it by the life itself. And what was she doing? She was choosing her life. I want the period in my life to come here with this story rather than to come over here with that other story. She was choosing the story of her life. I think that's a deep and important thing.
Well, I agree it's a deep and important thing, and I pretty much agree with what you say. A short record isn't necessarily not as good a record as a long record. Hey Jude was better than it would have been if it had only been 2 minutes long, but probably it's good that it didn't go on for an hour or two. Still, I think when a person makes a rational decision, that means they're choosing amongst the possibilities they can envisage the one that they prefer. A person has a right to make that choice. But as a caregiver, someone who cares about them, you ought to spend some time making sure not just that they've made the choice within the range of possibilities, but that the range of possibilities is as broad as it possibly could be. And there, I wasn't sure that Eastwood had done his job.
Oh, I think you're right. I mean, Eastwood struggled with his own conscience. I mean, he struggled for himself, but he didn't really engage her in any kind of real probing inquiry, you know, as to what are you doing? What really are you choosing? If he had engaged her in a probing inquiry, you could still see how it would be a kind of celebration of a life to end it by your own autonomous choice, right? And therefore define the character of your own life than to just suffer as the fate of circumstances.
But why couldn't the Eastwood character talk a little more? It's not that he was a dumb slug in a gym. He was sitting around reading poetry, learning Gaelic. He could have engaged her in a little more intelligent conversation.
You know, you're right. I mean, you're right. And he was a very thoughtful guy. But he's got this kind of almost Zen-like wisdom about when is the right time, you know? Given that character, he might have asked her, is this the right time? Is this the moment? But he doesn't do any of that. So maybe that's a weakness in the movie. Or maybe it's part of the character deciding, let her go. Let her have her wings and go.
I don't agree with those who criticize any sympathetic portrayal of euthanasia or those who help with euthanasia. I just have some nagging doubts whether the Eastwood character did everything he should have done in this particular case. Ken, it's fun talking about movies, but it's also fun to help our listeners talk about the philosophical problems that arise in our own life.
Yeah, if you've got a conundrum, you can send us an email at conundrums@philosophytalk.org. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Dave Fusaro, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association and from various groups at Stanford University.
And even more support from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and from the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.